This is Continent of Media 0505. Glenn Hauser here with the more or less monthly supplement to World of Radio. This program was recorded May 30th, 2005, to be known later as World of Radio Extra 59. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave equipment. Check their website, www.universal-radio.com, for more information, or you may request a catalog or via their toll-free number, 1-800-431-3939. Another website sponsored by Universal Radio is www.dxing.com, where you'll find a great deal of useful information, including an archive of DX Listening Digest and audio of this very program. Let us begin with one of the most pressing issues of the day, which I've not really devoted much time to on World Radio, digital broadcasting. In particular, so-called IBOC, the digital system for the medium wave and FM bands in the U.S. Some very cogent comments come from Harry Helms, which he puts on his blog, futureofradio.typepad.com. He says, IBOC, that stands for in-band on-channel, but it isn't really, will fail because it's 2005, not 1995. There is XM and Sirius, podcasting, and audio streaming to cell phones, coming online rapidly. IBOC's parent, Ubiquiti, needs revenues from license fees from broadcasters and receiver manufacturers to survive, and those revenues are not materializing. I wouldn't be surprised if Ubiquiti isn't even around in another 3 years. Their rapid, frantic efforts to push IBOC as a multicasting service instead of a high-quality audio service reeks of desperation. It's clear Ubiquiti grossly underestimated potential competition from new media and services. Their window to establish IBOC, or high definition, as a viable alternative to satellite, etc., is rapidly closing, and may have already closed. XM and Sirius have already captured almost 5 million listeners. Harry Helms continues, BPL, broadband over power lines, will likewise fail because it's 2005, not 1995. Wi-Fi clouds and new technologies like WiMAX are already providing cheap, in some cases free, wireless broadband at better rates than BPL can provide. Some cities like Philadelphia and Portland, Oregon, are already building municipal Wi-Fi networks that will provide free wireless broadband throughout the city. BPL is already obsolete, getting more so with each passing day. The rate of technological innovation these days in RF and wireless is nothing short of astonishing. AM, FM, and shortwave radio is indeed going to be very different in the future, but the change will come about through new technologies and changing listener preferences. On the IRCA list, Pat Martin in Oregon says, I was informed that National Public Radio gets a free lunch with IBOC. No fees to pay or anything. That explains why the chief engineer at the NPR station in Boise was so in favor of IBOC. He spoke to our club convention last year. Other CEs we spoke to were not pro-IBOC. In fact, he's one of the few I've run into that likes it. Of course, the money for the equipment is basically free, even if they have to pay for it as the money is donated. I would have a real problem donating to a station that was going to ruin my DXing hobby. Also on the IRCA list, Bob Foxworth in Florida says, my personal undocumented belief is that there is a collusion between a major station chain owner and a major three-letter trade association, and perhaps a major three-letter regulatory agency to reduce the number of stations, force all the smaller independents off the air, so the remaining big chain operations will have bigger shares of the pie, as the competition narrows the playing field. And the entry cost to move to IBOC is just one of these hurdles. So the marginal audience that is fragmented among all these niche players will be forced to move to the major operations for listenership. The emergence of satellite radio was probably not factored in when this plan was concocted several years ago. So the bigger operators are not being stupid, they're just being ruthless. That's just business. What I find distressing is the threat to our nation from foreign interests that seek to cause us great damage and economic turmoil, the threat to the cyber infrastructure is as real as the one to the physical infrastructure. Where this intersects with radio is that AM is probably the sole surviving medium that allows the instantaneous, low-tech dispersal of information in a multicast mode, that is, one sender, many receivers, to recipients over a wide geographical range. This was proved amply well in the Great Northeast Power Blackout in August 2003, when millions of people depended on nighttime Skywave AM for any information. On the NRC AM list, Jay Heil adds, there's still a need in day-to-day life for medium wave radio, and that's not even considering a natural disaster. I have a lot more faith in my $50 portable radios providing me emergency info in an earthquake or a hurricane than I do in my normally trusty internet connection. I can see myself huddled in the bathtub with a couple of flashlights and battery-powered radios when a tornado goes through and knocks out the power. I cannot see myself trying to get my internet connection to work in that situation. I'm one of the minority who have the equipment to receive high-definition TV. I also have a replay TV. Prior to getting HD, I almost never watched anything live. It was always watched when I had the time via replay. When I got the HD TV, I was in awe of the picture quality. On things originally recorded for high definition, it is truly stunning. I started watching many of my regular shows live because I wanted to see the much better picture and hear the Dolby Digital sound. The improved picture was fantastic. But after a few weeks, I started to tire of sitting through the endless commercials. Within a month, I was back to watching everything in standard definition via replay TV. The improved picture and sound just weren't worth wasting my time with the commercials. It was the same old stuff in a shinier package. Very quickly, I tired of looking at the package. It's essentially the same thing with iBuck. I've heard no talk of restructuring content to provide a better product to the customer. It'll be just like HDTV, same old stuff in a shinier, much more expensive package. Those comments from Jay Heil, H-E-Y-L. On the ABDX list, Darwin in Thousand Oaks, California says, I heard a first while monitoring KNX's interference effects, that's 1070 on XEPRS 1090. There was an ad against satellite radio in general. They told listeners that the content is very harmful to children and offensive to others, so don't buy a satellite radio because regular radio is safer and more decent. And use your iPod or other MP3 player for your music listening, they said. Harry Helms replies, there's no question about it. Terrestrial radio is scared, very scared. And the really funny thing is they're blind to the competition coming their way from cell phone casting, WiMAX, Wi-Fi clouds, etc. If they think satellite is bad, they haven't seen anything yet. Lesson in all this, if you spend enough time in a government-sanctioned oligopoly, you eventually forget how to compete, just like AT&T and the U.S. auto industry did. And in another posting, Harry Helms continues under this title, the IBOC train is stalled at the station and may never leave. Both pro and anti-IBOC advocates seem to be forgetting about this thing called a market and those people known as the public. It is the market, not the FCC nor Ubiquiti, that will determine whether IBOC will succeed. Ubiquiti is a for-profit company, and without revenues from radio broadcasters and receiver manufacturers, it can't survive. And that, in turn, depends on whether the public is enthusiastic enough about IBOC to go out and buy IBOC receivers in sufficient numbers to make it worthwhile for receiver manufacturers to tool up for IBOC and for radio stations to continue to pay Ubiquiti each month for the privilege of broadcasting in IBOC. Eventually, Ubiquiti has to generate enough revenue from IBOC to be self-sustaining. This is not yet happening. Ubiquiti is still living off venture capital and has had to return to its investors repeatedly for cash infusions instead of filing for an IPO. And you can bet your life they would have gone the IPO route by now if their numbers were anywhere near acceptability. For all the hype it's gotten, IBOC or HD has made very little impact on the public. Compare this to the impact podcasting has made, even though the very term was only coined 10 months ago. The difference in impact is because podcasting offers people something they really want, namely control over when, where, and how they listen to audio programming. Satellite radio offers the public a real benefit, a wide range of programming choices, and so it has likewise taken off. So what is IBOC and HD offering the public that is not already available from other new media delivery platforms, such as satellite radio and podcasting? Every time I ask this question of IBOC advocates, I get a non sequitur, and I suspect it's because even the biggest IBOC diehards know, in their heart of hearts, they don't have a strong product. IBOC or HD cannot be forced down the public's throats, even by law, if the public doesn't want it. Remember how successful the national 55-mile-per-hour speed limit was, or the U.S. was going to be 100% metric by 1985, or how about prohibition? IBOC won't succeed until the public decides they need it. Ubiquiti can't keep on collecting licensing fees from broadcasters and receiver manufacturers for much longer at the currently low adoption rates. Eventually, those two revenue sources will start balking at the low returns on their investments in IBOC programming and products. The market and market revenues will determine IBOC's fate. And so far, the market is not being very kind to Ubiquiti or IBOC, and Ubiquiti doesn't have a lot of time left to develop some compelling reasons for consumers to adopt it and to effectively communicate those reasons. If they don't, IBOC is going to remain essentially a stillborn technology, like the interactive video discs that were the next big thing a decade ago. The following comments from yours truly. It must be dark in New York. Did you ever notice how the 3 half-hour, or make that 21-minute newscast on NBC, CBS, and ABC television, refer to darkness, or at least impending darkness in the very titles? Here it is, 5:30 p.m., the sun is beating down as much as 3 hours before sunset, and we have the NBC Nightly News, ABC's World News Tonight. At least at CBS, it's only the evening news. To make matters worse, just like his predecessor, Brian Williams, who feels he has to punch every word to force us to listen, introduces every story with tonight. They must have kept the same writers or mandatory style book. Harry Shearer often made fun of Tom Brokaw by editing all his tonights from one show together into a row. Now, as a matter of fact, it is not night in New York, either, this time of year, especially with this daylight shifting nonsense making everything happen an hour earlier than it really should. Even in the dead of winter in this part of the country, 5:30 p.m. is more like evening than night. But then the central, not to mention the mountain zone, is so far beyond the Hudson as to be off the radar of the New York anchors, native Centralians that most of them may be. So why is nightness so important to these shows? Maybe they are to be taken more seriously than something airing in the day, but I, for one, am not fooled. Have you heard that Venezuela has started up a new satellite TV service, Telesur, prompted by President Chavez? BBC Monitoring reported on May 25th that test transmissions have begun. An ambitious Pan-American television project, Television of the South, based in Caracas. The project was given the go-ahead in January by Venezuela's controversial populist left-wing president, Hugo Chavez. He described it as a hemispheric audiovisual means of communication aimed at giving a true vision of the social and cultural diversity of Latin America and the Caribbean in order to offer it to the world, or an international counteroffensive against foreign criticism and a challenge to what he calls CNN's media dictatorship. Telesur's director general is Aram Aronian, a veteran Uruguayan journalist who has worked as a correspondent for numerous Latin American and European newspapers and agencies. He said the station's aim was to end the dominance of large media outlets, but he denied it's intended to compete directly with the likes of CNN. On May 27th, BBC Monitoring gave the technical details. La Nueva Televisora del Sur, they're actually calling it, the New Television of the South, or Telesur for short, was broadcasting in the clear from the NSS 806 satellite 40.5 degrees west, May 26th at 1100 GMT. The transponder frequency 4029 MHz, right-hand circular polarization. Symbol rate 5632, FEC 34, video PID 33, audio PID 34, and SID 42. For half an hour, they're running a promotional video emphasizing the way news will be reported in the future. The website is www.telesurtv.net. giving an address in Caracas, and an email address of contactenos@telesurtv.net. This is Continental Media 0505. Your input and comments always welcome to P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. Check our website, worldofradio.com, for the Continent of Media summaries. In the summary for this edition, as for all of them, you'll find links to DX Listening Digest issues where you may read much more about the topics I mention here, such as an article about the history of radio broadcasting in Guyana. It appeared in Conexión Digital and in turn came from a website called www.silvertorch.com. I'll just mention the early years here. Radio broadcasts were started in then British Guiana in the 1920s by a number of enthusiasts. In 1926, just 4 years after the BBC started regular broadcasting in Britain, there was a small wired service that relayed broadcasts, especially from the BBC's Daventry transmitter, over the Georgetown telephone system. From 1927, however, experimental shortwave broadcasts on 47 meters and later on 43.86 meters were introduced for 2 hours a week. This lasted until 1931, when economic considerations brought the effort to an end. In 1935, broadcasts were resumed in order to receive commentaries on the current MCC cricket matches. They were so successful that two radio stations, VP3BG and VP3MR, were established and operated on a commercial basis until they merged in 1938 to form the British Guiana United Broadcasting Company Limited, operating station ZFY from the main post office in Georgetown until it was destroyed by fire in February 1945. I believe I've already mentioned on World of Radio that XETRA 690 in Tijuana will be changing ownership and format later this year. In his broadcast band update May 14th, Craig Hardison writes about the old Extra. Heard for decades in Southern California over Extra 690, blasting forth from just across the border in Tijuana, Clear Channel is now renting out this 77,500-watt signal to give a home to its adult standards format as 690 The Lounge. This all ends no later than next year under fairly new FCC regulations, which now count the arrangement as constituting a full-blown San Diego station. While Clear Channel already owns 8, the maximum of its own U.S. licensed stations in San Diego. 690 has featured English lingo formats since the 1950s, first as rocker XEAK, later as Earth's first all-news station, thus the call sign Extra, really XETRA, although I interject, IGH, that in print the E looked like a dash. He continues, current owners have sold this beast to the Madrid-based Grupo Prisa, which publishes Spain's largest newspaper and owns or programs some 1,000 stations in Europe and Latin America, as well as WSUA 1260 in Miami. Grupo Prisa is affiliated with Mexico's largest broadcaster, Televisa. Speculation is that programming will consist of Spanish-language news talk, possibly originating at Televisa's giant 250-kilowatt flagship, if it still is that powerful, XEW 900 in Mexico City. On the ABDX list, we had an interesting thread about broadcasting in the Catalina Islands. First from Tom Bryant, now in Nashville. A week ago, I was privileged to see something not many DXers have eyeballed, the transmitter site and towers of KBRT 740, Avalon, Santa Catalina Island, formerly known as KBIG, KBIG. Catalina is a place I've always wanted to go. The city of Avalon is relatively small, only about 4,000 full-time residents, and a handful more scattered across the island. I first heard about this station in 1953, when it was KBIG, from my seventh grade teacher. He had a brother in North Hollywood who vacationed in California and would always talk about his favorite station, broadcasting from Avalon, playing a lot of easy listening and big band music. They played a short version of the song Avalon every hour on the hour, along with their legal ID. About 5 miles north of civilization, the three towers came into view, and I couldn't help but hear the strains of that famous Jan Garber song wafting through the airwaves of my mind. I could even hear the Four Preps harmonizing on another famous Catalina song, 26 Miles. K-Big is long gone, owners and formats have changed, but those triple towers still pump out 10 kilowatts of signal that pound into Los Angeles. There's a great website at sakrison.com/radio/KBRT in caps.html. Darwin in Thousand Oaks says, Avalon used to have an FM station on 92.7 at 100 watts. They got out really well when my local station was off, but I can't seem to find it lately. The answer comes from Greg Hardison. Although I've spent way too many years in Southern California, I've never been to Santa Catalina Island, but I can divulge the fate of 92.7, the former island station, KLIT-FM, which was purchased by the Amaturo Group, owner of the Thousand Oaks station, on 92.7. It was moved to the mainland, now licensed to Fountain Valley in Orange County, transmitting from a hilltop just east of Newport Beach. Catalina does play home to non-commercial KISL 88.7. There's some great photos of their installation at www.well.com/user/DMSML/KISL. Still on the ABDX list, news from the CGC Communicator about a permit granted for a new TV station in Avalon on Channel 54, KAZA. Licensed to Pappas, Southern California. However, Tom Bryant says a little snooping determined that the analog and digital transmitter for this station are or will be on Mount Wilson. It looks like the analog is already on the air. Avalon is nothing more than the city of license, and with the directional antenna, there's no doubt they'll toss a city-grade signal over to the island. Aaron Zawitski refers us to something from the Center for Digital Democracy, that's www.democraticmedia.org. On May 19th, the Washington Watch column by Patricia Harrison. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting's propagandist-in-chief, Ken Tomlinson, and his choice for its next president, another government propagandist. A conflict of interest between his role as chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors and CPB is another reason why he should resign. All those are headlines and subheadlines. The story starts, Kenneth Tomlinson is a very busy man, holding down the board of directors chairs at two U.S. government-connected agencies. While better known outside the Beltway for his role as chair of CPB, Tomlinson also oversees the U.S.'s official propaganda arm, the Broadcasting Board of Governors. He serves as chair and member since 2002. We'll include a link to the entire article. Some not-too-flattering comments about U.S. international broadcasting. On the shortwave programs list, Kevin Anderson in Iowa says, Now and previously, I for some reason have never been able to accept the VOA in the same way I can accept the BBC World Service. Even though I know they strive to present a non-propagandist source, it nonetheless still seems to always come off as propagandist to me. It may be simply in their choice of voices doing the crossovers between programmers or their choice of film music or the voices of the newscasters, I'm not sure what it is. But I know that whenever I run across a VOA broadcast on the wireless, I can recognize it almost immediately, and my gut inside reaction is to keep tuning past them in search of something else. Call this shallow, but in 25-plus years of listening to shortwave, I can't seem to shake it. I can't seem to find myself to see the VOA with the same credibility as I so easily came to ascribe to the BBC, or even Radio Netherlands or RCI, just to name a few. My mind always wants to assume there is an agenda hidden behind VOA choices of what it says and how they say it. I'm thrilled to hear that others in the world have, and apparently still do, look to the VOA for news and information. Somehow, I cannot, says Kevin Anderson. And these comments from Charles A. Taylor in the IRCA list. I served 32 years inside the bowels of the federal government, the last 16 at VOA. At least at the transmission end of the chain of broadcast, the U.S. government has been very inefficient and wasteful of money. The two old Continental U.S. VOA plants were owned and staffed by Crosley, WLWO in Ohio, and CBS, KCBR in California, and others, such as in BC, also in California, coming into VOA long after the privately owned transmitter plants were federalized, I'd have to say they did the job efficiently and with a proper increase in contract cost to make a profit. Still would have beat the government at doing it well. The lore of the old KCBR, Delano, still figures big around the transmitting station in terms of photos of that era and in records kept and stories told of the personnel. All the original personnel were federalized and also have passed away or retired. As an alumnus of the Greenville transmitting station, who served out at Delano for 2 years, I cannot possibly deny that the old networks did the job much more efficiently than the federal government. Rich Franklin of WNAR would like us to publicize his streaming station, Golden Age Recreation Radio. Well, it's also on 1620 AM. He says the frequencies have changed, a very low-power station, also changed their web stream server. He calls it Old-Time Radio Recreation Station, WNAR AM. Everything old is new again. Old and new radios are hungry for old radio programs. A not-for-profit, historic, old-time community radio recreation station. www.wnar-am.com. Great Hollywood stars, stories, drama, adventure, plays, music, mystery, and history. Theater of the imagination. Descriptive narration is especially useful for the visually impaired. Thanks for the promotion. Contact information is on our website. Listen for free and please spread the word. Finally, from the world of telephones, this from the CGC communicator via Kevin Redding, ABDX, a status report on the long-distance dial around 1010-229, a new service that appears to have reached the penny-a-minute barrier for overseas calling to Germany and several other countries, and 2 cents a minute to cities within the U.S. CGC placed 6 brief test calls in early April to Palm Springs, Washington, D.C., Mexico City, and Norway. We wanted to see what charges would actually appear on our bill, as opposed to word-of-mouth charges that the voice announcement at the beginning of each call says would be 1 cent per minute for foreign calls, 2 cents for domestic. The fees were billed as advertised, except that a 20-cent per call connection fee was added to the bill. Still, that's pretty low. Check their website, www.1010229.com/index2.php. And that concludes Continental Media 0505, also known as World of Radio Extra 59. I'm Glenn Hauser.